contracts for the delivery of a variety of commodities, from grains to metals as well as foreign exchange. It's a fast market where professionals can benefit greatly, but individuals who don't know what they're doing can easily get clobbered. My advice to the non-professional investor, don't go against the grain. I would also steer clear of hedge fund and private equity and venture capital funds. These can be great money makers for the fund managers who pocket large management fees and 20% of the profits, but individual investors are unlikely to benefit. The average performance of these funds is deeply disappointing. True, the best funds have done quite well, but unless you are an institutional investor who has established a clearly preferential position, your chance of investing with the best is realistically zero. Ignore these exotics. They are not for you. Exercise 9. Remember that investment costs are not random. Some are lower than others. Many brokers today will execute your stock orders at substantial discounts off standard commission rates. The discount broker usually provides a plain pipe rack service. If you want your hand held, if you want general portfolio advice and investment suggestions, the discount broker may not be for you. If, however, you know exactly what you want to buy, the discount broker can get it for you at much lower commission rates than the standard full-service house, especially if you are willing to trade online. Trading stocks online is easy and cheap. But let me warn you, few investors who try to trade in and out of stocks each day make profits. Don't let low commission rates seduce you into becoming one of the legion of unsuccessful former day traders. While we are on the subject of commission costs, you should be aware of a Wall Street innovation called the wrap account. For a single fee, your broker obtains the services of a professional money manager who then selects for you a portfolio of stocks, bonds, and perhaps real estate. Brokerage commissions and advisory fees are wrapped into the overall fee. The costs involved in wrap accounts are extremely high. Annual fees can be up to 3% per year, and there may be additional execution fees and fund expenses if the manager uses mutual funds or REITs. With those kinds of expenses, it will be virtually impossible for you to beat the market. My advice here is, avoid taking the wrap. Remember also that costs matter when buying mutual funds or ETFs. There is a strong tendency for those funds that charge the lowest fees to the investor to produce the best net returns. The fund industry is one where you actually get what you don't pay for. Of course, the quintessential low-cost funds are index funds, which tend to be very tax-efficient as well. There is much about investing you cannot control. You can't do anything about the ups and downs of the stock and bond markets, but you can control your investment costs. And you can organize your investments to minimize taxes. Controlling the things you can control should play a central role in developing a sensible investment strategy. Exercise 10. Avoid sinkholes and stumbling blocks. Diversify your investment steps. In these warm-up exercises, we have discussed a number of investment instruments. The most important part of our walk down Wall Street will take us to the corner of Broad Street, to a consideration of sensible investment strategies with respect to common stocks. A guide to this part of our walk is contained in the final three chapters because I believe common stocks should form the cornerstone of most portfolios. Nevertheless, in our final warm-up exercise, we recall the important lesson of modern portfolio theory, the advantages of diversification. A biblical proverb states that in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. The same can be said of investments. Diversification reduces risk and makes it far more likely that you will achieve the kind of good average long-run return that meets your investment objective. Therefore, within each investment category, you should hold a variety of individual issues. And although common stocks should be a major part of your portfolio, they should not be the sole investment instrument. Just remember the teary-eyed ex-Enron employees who held nothing but Enron stock in their retirement plans. When Enron went under, they lost not only their jobs, but all their retirement savings as well. Whatever the investment objectives, the investor who is wise diversifies. Recall also the sinkholes and stumbling blocks covered in the section of Chapter 10 entitled What Are the Lessons for Investors from Behavioral Finance? We are all too often our own worst enemy when it comes to investing. An understanding of how vulnerable we are to our own psychology can help us avoid the common pitfalls that can make us stumble on our walk down Wall Street. A final checkup. Now that you have completed your warm-up exercises, let's take a moment for a final checkup. The theories of valuation worked out by economists and the performance recorded by the professionals lead to a single conclusion. There is no sure and easy road to riches. High returns can be achieved only through higher risk-taking, and perhaps through acceptance of lesser degrees of liquidity. The amount of risk you can tolerate is partly determined by your sleeping point. The next chapter discusses the risks and rewards of stock and bond investing and will help you determine the kinds of returns you should expect from different financial instruments. But the risk you can assume is also significantly influenced by your age and by the sources and dependability of your non-investment income. Chapter 14, A Life Cycle Guide to Investing, will give you a clearer notion of how to decide what portion of your capital should be placed in common stocks, bonds, real estate, and short-term investments. The final chapter presents specific stock market strategies that will enable amateur investors to achieve results as good as or better than those of the most sophisticated professionals. Chapter 13. Handicapping the Financial Race. A Primer in Understanding and Projecting Returns from Stocks and Bonds. From Thomas B. Macaulay, History of England. No man who is correctly informed as to the past will be disposed to take a morose or desponding view of the present. This is the chapter where you learn how to become a financial bookie. Reading it will still leave you unable to predict the course of the market over the next month or the next year. No one can do that, but you will be able to better the odds of constructing a winning portfolio. Although the price levels of stocks and bonds, the two most important determinants of net worth, will undoubtedly fluctuate beyond your control, my general methodology will serve you well in realistically projecting long-run returns and adapting your investment program to your financial needs. What determines the returns from stocks and bonds? Very long-run returns from common stocks are driven by two critical factors: the dividend yield at the time of purchase and the future growth rate of earnings and dividends. In principle, for the buyer who holds his or her stocks forever, a share of common stock is worth the present or discounted value of its stream of future dividends. Recall that this discounting reflects the fact that a dollar received tomorrow is worth less than a dollar in hand today. A stock buyer purchases an ownership interest in a business and hopes to receive a growing stream of dividends. Even if a company pays very small dividends today and retains most or even all of its earnings to reinvest in the business, the investor implicitly assumes that such reinvestment will lead to a more rapidly growing stream of dividends in the future, or alternatively, to greater earnings that can be used by the company to buy back its stock. The discounted value of this stream of dividends, or funds returned to shareholders through stock buybacks, can be shown to produce a very simple formula for the long-run total return for either an individual stock or the market as a whole. Long-run equity return equals initial dividend yield plus growth rate. From 1926 until 2013, for example, common stocks provided an average annual rate of return of about 10%. The dividend yield for the market as a whole on January 1, 1926, was about 5%. The long-run rate of growth of earnings and dividends was also about 5%. Thus, adding the initial dividend yield to the growth rate gives a close approximation of the actual rate of return. Over shorter periods, such as a year or even several years, a third factor is critical in determining returns. This factor is the change in valuation relationships, specifically the change in the price dividend or price earnings multiple. Increases or decreases in the price dividend multiple tend to move in the same direction as the more popularly used price earnings multiple. Price dividend and price earnings multiples vary widely from year to year. For example, in times of great optimism, such as early March 2000, stocks sold at price earnings multiples well above 30. The price dividend multiple was over 80. At times of great pessimism, such as 1982, stocks sold at only 8 times earnings and 17 times dividends. These multiples are also influenced by interest rates. When interest rates are low, stocks which compete with bonds for an investor's savings tend to sell at low dividend yields and high price earnings multiples. When interest rates are high, stock yields rise to be more competitive, and stocks tend to sell at low price earnings multiples. Common stock returns were well below average from 1968 to 1982, when returns were only about 5.5% per year. Stocks sold at a dividend yield of 3% at the start of the period, and earnings and dividend growth was 6% per year, a bit above the long-run average. Had price earnings multiples and dividend yields remained constant, stocks would have produced a 9% annual return, with the 6% dividend growth translated into 6% capital appreciation per year. But a large increase in dividend yields, a large fall in price earnings multiples, reduced the average annual return by about 3.5 percentage points per year. A perfectly dreadful period for stock market investors was the first decade of the 2000s. The age of millennium turned out to be the age of disenchantment. At the start of April 2000, at the height of the internet bubble, the dividend yield for the S&P 500 had fallen to 1.2%. Price earnings multiples were above 30. Dividend growth was actually very strong during the period, averaging 5.8% per year. Had there been no change in valuation relationships, stocks would have produced a rate of return of 7%, 1.2% dividend yield plus 5.8% growth. But price earnings multiples plummeted, and dividend yields rose over the decade. The change in valuation relationships lopped 13.5 percentage points from the return. Hence, stocks did not return 7%. They lost an average of 6.5% per year, leading many analysts to refer to these years as the lost decade. Many analysts question whether dividends are as relevant now as they were in the past. They argue that firms increasingly prefer distributing their growing earnings to stockholders through stock repurchases rather than dividend increases. Two reasons are offered for such behavior. One serves shareholders and the other management. The shareholder benefit was created by tax laws. The tax rate on realized long-term capital gains has often been only a fraction of the maximum income tax rate on dividends. Firms that buy back stock tend to reduce the number of shares outstanding and therefore increase earnings per share and thus share prices. Hence, stock buybacks tend to create capital gains. Even when dividends and capital gains are taxed at the same rate, capital gains taxes can be deferred until the stocks are sold or even avoided completely if the shares are later bequeathed. Thus, managers acting in the interest of the shareholder will prefer to engage in buybacks rather than increasing dividends. The flip side of stock repurchases is more self-serving. A significant part of management compensation is derived from stock options, which become valuable only if earnings and the price of the stock rise. Stock repurchases are an easy way to bring this about. Larger appreciation benefits the managers by enhancing the value of their stock options, whereas larger dividends go into the pockets of current shareholders. From the 1940s until the 1970s, earnings and dividends grew at about the same rate. During the last decades of the 20th century, however, earnings grew faster than dividends. Over the very long run, earnings and dividends are likely to grow at roughly similar rates. Long-run returns from bonds are easier to calculate than those from stocks. Over the long run, the yield that a bond investor receives is approximated by the yield to maturity of the bond at the time it is purchased. For a zero-coupon bond, a bond that makes no periodic interest payments but simply returns a fixed amount at maturity, the yield at which it is purchased is precisely the yield that an investor will receive, assuming no default and assuming it is held to maturity. For a coupon-paying bond, a bond that does make periodic interest payments, there could be a slight variation in the yield that is earned over the term of the bond, depending on whether and at what interest rates the coupon interest is reinvested. Nevertheless, the initial yield on the bond provides a quite serviceable estimate of the yield that will be obtained by an investor who holds the bond until maturity. Estimating bond returns becomes murky when bonds are not held until maturity. Changes in interest rates, bond yields, then become a major factor in determining the net return received over the period during which the bond is held. When interest rates rise, bond prices fall so as to make existing bonds competitive with those that are currently being issued at the higher interest rates. When rates fall, bond prices increase. The principle to keep in mind is that bond investors who don't hold to maturity will suffer to the extent that interest rates rise and gain to the extent that rates fall. Inflation is the dark horse in any handicapping of financial returns. In the bond market, an increase in the inflation rate is unambiguously bad. To see this, suppose that there was no inflation and bonds sold on a 5% yield basis, providing investors with a real, that is, after inflation, return of 5%. Now assume that the inflation rate increases from 0 to 5% per year. If investors still require a 5% real rate of return, then the bond interest rate must rise to 10%. Only then would investors receive an after-inflation return of 5%. But this will mean that bond prices fall, and those who previously purchased 5% long-term bonds will suffer a substantial capital loss. Except for the holder of the inflation-protected bonds recommended in Chapter 12, inflation is the deadly enemy of the bond investor. In principle, common stocks should be an inflation hedge, and stocks are not supposed to suffer with an increase in the inflation rate. In theory, at least, if the inflation rate rises by one percentage point, including the values of factories, equipment, and inventories. Consequently, the growth rate of earnings and dividends should rise with the rate of inflation. Thus, even though all required returns will rise with the rate of inflation, no change in dividend yields or price-earnings ratios will be required. This is so because expected growth rates should rise along with increases in the expected inflation rate. Whether this happens, in practice, we will examine below. Four historical eras of financial market returns. Before we attempt to project future stock and bond returns, let's examine four periods of stock and bond market history and see whether we can make sense of how investors fared in terms of the determinants of returns discussed above. The four eras coincide with the four broad swings in stock market returns from 1947 to 2009. Era 1, the Age of Comfort as I call it, covers the years of growth after World War II. Stockholders made out extremely well after inflation, whereas the meager returns earned by bondholders were substantially below the average inflation rate. I call Era 2 the Age of Angst. Widespread rebellion by the millions of teenagers born during the baby boom, economic and political instability created by the Vietnam War, and various inflationary oil and food shocks combined to create an inhospitable climate for investors. No one was exempt. Neither stocks nor bonds fared well. During our third era, the Age of Exuberance, the boomers matured, peace reigned, and a non-inflationary prosperity set in. It was a golden age for stockholders and bondholders. Never before had they earned such generous returns. Era 4 was the age of disenchantment, in which the great promise of the new millennium was not reflected in common stock returns. With these broad time periods set, let us now look at how the determinants of returns developed during those eras and look especially at what might have been responsible for changes in valuation relationships and in interest rates. Recall that stock returns are determined by 1. The initial dividend yield at which the stocks were purchased, 2. The growth rate of earnings, and 3. Changes in valuation in terms of price-earnings or price-dividend ratios. And bond returns are determined by 1. The initial yield to maturity at which the bonds were purchased, and 2. Changes in interest rates, yields, and therefore in bond prices for bond investors who do not hold to maturity. Era 1. The Age of Comfort. Consumers celebrated the end of World War II with a spending spree. They had gone without cars, refrigerators, and countless other goods during the war, and they forked over their liquid savings with abandon, creating a mini-boom with some inflation. It was hard, however, to forget the Great Depression of the 1930s. Economists, those dismal scientists, were worried as demand began to slacken and became convinced that a deep recession or perhaps a depression was just around the corner. President Harry Truman was responsible for a widely used definition of the difference between the two. A recession is when you're out of work. A depression is when I'm out of work. Investors in the stock market noted the economists' gloom and were clearly worried. Dividend yields at the start of 1947 were unusually high at 5%, and P.E. multiples, which hovered around 12, were well below their long-term average. It turned out that the economy did not sink into the depression many had feared. Although there were periods of mild recession, the economy grew at a quite reasonable rate through the 1950s and 1960s. President Kennedy had proposed a large tax cut in the early 1960s, which was enacted in 1964 after his death. With the stimulus from the tax cut and the increase in government spending for the Vietnam War, the economy was robust with high employment levels. Inflation was generally not a problem until the very end of the period. Investors became progressively more confident. By 1968, P.E.s were above 18, and the yield on the S&P 500 stock index had fallen to 3%. This created truly comfortable conditions for common stock investors. Their initial dividends were high. Both earnings and dividends grew at reasonably robust rates of 6.5% to 7%, and valuations became richer, further augmenting capital gains. Unfortunately, bond investors did not fare nearly as well. For starters, initial bond yields were low in 1947. Thus, bond returns were destined to be low even for investors who held to maturity. During World War II, the United States pegged long-term government bond interest rates at no more than 2.5%. The policy was implemented to permit the government to finance the war cheaply with low-interest borrowing, and it continued after the war until 1951, when rates were allowed to rise moderately. Therefore, bond investors suffered a double whammy during the period. Not only were interest rates artificially low at the start of the period, but bondholders suffered capital losses when interest rates were allowed to rise. As a result, bondholders received nominal rates of return below 2% over the period and real returns after inflation that were negative. Era 2, the Age of Angst. From the late 1960s through the early 1980s, accelerating inflation made an unexpected appearance and became the major influence on securities markets. In the mid-1960s, inflation was essentially unnoticeable, running at a rate of just over 1%. When our involvement in Vietnam increased in the late 1960s, however, we had classic, old-fashioned demand-pull inflation, too much money chasing too few goods, and the rate of inflation spurted forward to about 4 or 4.5%. Then, the economy was beset by the oil and food shocks of 1973-1974. It was a classic case of Murphy's Law at work. Whatever could go wrong, did. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, contrived to produce an artificial shortage of oil, and Mother Nature produced a real shortage of foodstuffs through poor grain harvests in North America and disastrous ones in the Soviet Union and sub-Saharan Africa. When even the Peruvian anchovy crop mysteriously disappeared, anchovies are a major source of protein, it appears that O'Toole's commentary had come into play. Remember, it was O'Toole who suggested that Murphy was an optimist. Again, the inflation rate rose to 6.5%. Then, in 1978 and 1979, a combination of policy mistakes, leading to considerable excess demand in certain sectors, and another 125% increase in the price of oil kicked the inflation rate up again, taking with it wage costs. By the early 1980s, the inflation rate went above 10%, and there was considerable fear that the economy was out of control. Finally, the Federal Reserve, under the leadership of its chairman at the time, Paul Volcker, took decisive action. The Fed initiated an extremely tight monetary policy designed to rein in the economy and kill the inflationary virus. Inflation did begin to subside in time, but the economy almost died as well. We suffered the sharpest economic decline since the 1930s, and unemployment soared. By the end of 1981, the U.S. economy suffered not only from double-digit inflation, but from double-digit unemployment as well. Although nominal returns for both stockholders and bondholders were meager, the real returns, after factoring out the 7.8% inflation rate, were actually negative. On the other hand, hard assets such as gold, collectibles, and real estate provided generous double-digit returns. Because the inflation was unanticipated, an allowance for it was not incorporated into yields, investors in bonds suffered disastrous results. In 1968, for example, 30-year long-term bonds offered a yield to maturity of about 6%. This provided protection against the going inflation rate of about 3% and an anticipated after-inflation real rate of return of 3%. Unfortunately, the actual rate of inflation over the period 1969 to 1981 was almost 8%, wiping out any positive real rate of return. That's the good news part of this dreary story. The bad news was that there were capital losses. Who wanted to buy a bond yielding 6% in the late 1970s when the rate of inflation was in double digits? No one. If you had to sell your bonds, you sold at a loss so that the new buyer could get a yield consonant with the higher rate of inflation. Yields rose even further as the risk premium on bonds rose to take into account their increased volatility. To make matters worse, the tax system delivered the unkindest blow of all to bond investors. Even though bond investors often actually earned negative pre-tax rates of return, their bond coupons were taxed at regular income tax rates. The failure of bonds to protect investors against an unanticipated inflationary episode is hardly surprising. The common stock flop was something else. Because stocks represent claims on real assets that presumably rise in value with the price level, stock prices, according to this line of logic, should have risen also. It's like the story of a small boy on his first trip to an art museum. When told that a famous abstract painting was supposed to be a horse, the boy asked wisely, "Well, if it's supposed to be a horse, why isn't it a horse?" If common stocks were supposed to be an inflation hedge, then why weren't they? Many different explanations involving faltering dividends and earnings growth have been offered that simply don't hold up under careful analysis. One common explanation was that inflation had caused corporate profits to shrink drastically, especially when reported figures were adjusted for inflation. Inflation was portrayed as a kind of financial neutron bomb, leaving the structure of corporate enterprise intact but destroying the lifeblood of profits. Many saw the engine of capitalism as running out of control, so that a walk down Wall Street, random or otherwise, could prove extremely hazardous. The facts are, however, that there was no evidence that profits had been sliding down a pole greased by cruel and inexorable inflation, as some in the financial community believed in the early 1980s. Profit growth accelerated over the 1969 to 1981 period and increased to an 8% rate, comfortably ahead of inflation. Even dividends held their own, rising at close to the same rate as inflation. Movie buffs should recall the marvelous final scene from Casablanca. Humphrey Bogart stands over the body of a Luftwaffe major, a smoking gun in his hand. Claude Rains, a captain in the French colonial police, turns his glance from Bogart to the smoking gun, to the dead major, and finally to his assistant, and says, "Major Strasser has been shot. Round up the usual suspects." We too have rounded up the usual suspects, but we have yet to focus on who shot the stock market. The major reason for the poor equity returns during the 1970s was that investors' evaluations of dividends and earnings, the number of dollars they were willing to pay for a dollar of dividends and earnings, fell sharply. Stocks failed to provide investors with protection against inflation, not because earnings and dividends failed to grow with inflation, but rather because price-earnings multiples quite literally collapsed over the period. The price-earnings multiple for the S&P index was cut by almost two-thirds during the 1969 to 1981 period. It was this decline in multiples that produced such poor returns for investors in the 1970s and that prevented stock prices from reflecting the real underlying progress most companies made in earnings and dividend growth. Some financial economists concluded that the market was simply irrational during the 1970s and early 1980s, that multiples had fallen too far. It is, of course, quite possible that stock investors became irrationally pessimistic in the early 1980s, just as they were possibly irrationally optimistic in the mid-1960s. But although I do not believe the market is always perfectly rational, if forced to choose between the stock market and the economics profession, I'd put my money on the stock market every time. I suspect that stock investors weren't irrational when they caused a sharp drop in price dividend and price earnings multiples. They were just scared. In the mid-1960s, inflation was so modest as to be almost unnoticeable, and investors were convinced that economists had found the cure for serious recessions. Even mild downturns could be fine-tuned away. No one would have imagined in the 1960s that the economy could experience either double-digit unemployment or double-digit inflation, let alone that both could appear simultaneously. Clearly, we learned that economic conditions were far less stable than had previously been imagined. Equity securities, dare I say equity insecurities, were therefore considered riskier and deserving of higher risk compensation. Economists often put the proposition in terms of the risk premium, that is, the extra return you can expect from an investment over and above the return from perfectly predictable short-term investments. According to this view, the risk premiums in the 1960s were very small, perhaps 1 or 2 percentage points. During the early 1980s, risk premiums demanded by investors to hold both stocks and bonds expanded to a range of probably 4 to 6 percentage points. The market provides higher risk premiums through a drop in prices relative to earnings and dividends. This produces larger returns in the future consistent with the new riskier environment. Paradoxically, however, the same adjustments that produced very poor returns in the late 1960s and throughout the 1970s created some very attractive price levels in the early 1980s, as I argued in earlier editions of this book. The experience makes clear, however, that if one wants to explain the generation of returns over a decade, a change in valuation relationships plays a critical role. The growth rate of earnings did compensate for inflation during 1969 to 1981, but the drop in price dividend and price earnings multiples, which I believe reflected increased perceived risk, is what killed the stock market. Era 3. The Age of Exuberance. Let us now turn to the third era, the golden age of financial asset returns from 1982 through early 2000. At the start of the period, both bonds and stocks had fully adjusted, perhaps even over-adjusted, to the changed economic environment. Stocks and bonds were priced not only to provide adequate protection against the likely rate of inflation, but also to give unusually generous real rates of return. Indeed, in late 1981, the bond market was in disgrace. The Wall Street Journal, in its 1981 annual comedy issue, wrote, "A bond is a fixed-rate instrument designed to fall in price." At the time, the yield on high-quality corporate bonds was around 13%. The underlying rate of inflation, as measured by the growth of unit labor costs, was then about 8%. Thus, corporate bonds provided a prospective real rate of return of about 5%, a rate unusually generous by past historical standards. The long-term real rate of return on corporate bonds has been only 2%. To be sure, bond prices had become volatile, and it was therefore reasonable to suppose that bonds ought to offer a somewhat larger risk premium than before. but panic-depressive institutional investors probably over-discounted the risks of bond investments. Like generals fighting the last war, investors had been loath to touch bonds because experience over the past 15 years had been so disastrous. Thus, the initial conditions were such that bond investors could expect very generous returns in the years ahead. What about stocks? As I mentioned above, it is possible to calculate the anticipated long-run rate of return on stocks by adding the dividend yield of the stock averages to the anticipated growth of earnings per share. The calculations I performed in 1981 suggested a total expected rate of return from common stocks of more than 13%, a rate well above the core rate of inflation and very generous by historical standards. Common stocks were also selling at unusually low multiples of cyclically depressed earnings, at below-average price dividend multiples, and at prices that were only a fraction of the replacement value of the assets they represented. Small wonder that we saw so many corporate takeovers during the 1980s. Whenever assets can be bought in the stock market at less than the cost of acquiring them directly, there will be a tendency for firms to purchase the equities of other firms as well as to buy back their own stocks. Thus, I argued that in the early 1980s, we were presented with a market situation where paper assets had adjusted and perhaps over-adjusted to inflation and the greater uncertainty associated with it. This was truly an age of investor exuberance, with both stocks and bonds producing unusually generous rates of return. Although the nominal growth in earnings and dividends was not any greater during this period than in the unsatisfactory period of the 1970s, two factors contributed to produce spectacular stock market returns. First, initial dividend yields of nearly 6% were unusually generous. Second, market sentiment went from despair to euphoria. Price earnings multiples in the market almost quadrupled from 8 to 30, and dividend yields fell to just over 1%. It was the change in valuation that lifted stock returns from unusually good to absolutely extraordinary. Similarly, the initial yield of 13% in the bond market guaranteed that long-term holders would achieve double-digit returns. As I have said, what yield long-term holders see is what they get. In addition, interest rates fell, augmenting the returns further. Moreover, because the inflation rate moderated to the 3% level, real returns after inflation, were well above their long-term average. The 1982 to early 2000 period offered a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be invested in financial assets. Meanwhile, hard assets such as gold and oil produced negative rates of return. Era 4. The Age of Disenchantment. The Age of Exuberance was followed by one of the worst decades for the stock market ever recorded. The period was widely considered to be the lost decade, or the noughties. It was a decade most stock market investors would prefer to forget. The internet bubble was followed by a crushing bear market. Later in the decade, another bubble and crash rocked world stock markets as tumbling real estate prices destroyed the value of the complex mortgage-backed securities that were dependent on rising home prices. Investors were again reminded that the world was a very risky place. Valuation relationships changed accordingly. Price-earning ratios fell and dividend yields rose. The investor who diversified her portfolio with bonds was able to mitigate the suffering, however, as bonds produced positive returns over the decade. The markets from 2009 through 2014. By the trough in a market in 2009, the P.E. multiple for the S&P 500 had fallen to less than 15 times cyclically depressed earnings. The dividend yield had increased to almost 3%. These changes in valuation relationships created the conditions for positive stock market returns over the next 5 years. As earnings grew at double-digit rates, prices rose even more, aided by falling dividend yields and rising P.E. multiples. Bonds also did reasonably well. U.S. Treasury yields ranged between 3 and 4% in 2009. In mid-2014, the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond yielded about 2.5%. Thus, bonds offered some capital appreciation as their yields fell. handicapping future returns. So, what's ahead? How can you judge returns from financial assets for the years ahead? Although I remain convinced that no one can predict short-term movements in securities markets, I do believe that it is possible to estimate the likely range of long-run rates of return that investors can expect from financial assets. And it would be unrealistic to anticipate that the generous returns earned by stock market investors during the 2009-2014 period can be expected during the years ahead. What, then, are the reasonable long-run expectations for returns? The same methods that I used in the past can be used today. I will illustrate the long-run return projections as of late 2014. The reader can perform similar calculations by using data appropriate for the time the projection is made. Looking first at the bond market as of late 2014, we can get a very good idea of the returns that will be gained by long-term holders. Holders of good quality corporate bonds will earn approximately 4.5% if they hold the bonds to maturity. Holders of 10-year treasury bonds until maturity will earn just over 2%. Assuming that the inflation rate does not exceed 2% per year, both government and corporate bonds will provide investors with a positive but quite meager rate of return. These yields, however, are considerably lower than they have been since the late 1960s. Moreover, if inflation accelerates and interest rates rise, bond prices will fall and bond returns will be even lower. It is hard to imagine that bond investors will be well served by the yields available in 2014. What returns can we project for common stocks as of late 2014? We can make reasonable estimates of at least the first two determinants of equity returns. We know that the 2014 dividend yield for the S&P 500 index was about 1.9%. Suppose that earnings can grow at about 5% over the long term, a rate consistent with historical rates during periods of restrained inflation and similar to estimates made by Wall Street securities firms in late 2014. Adding the initial yield and growth rate together, we get a projected total return for the S&P 500 of just under 7% per year, higher than bond yields but somewhat below the long-term average since 1926, which had been close to 10%. Of course, the major determinants of stock returns over short periods of time will be changes in the ways equities are valued in the market, that is, changes in market price earnings multiples. Investors should ask themselves whether the valuation levels in the market during late 2014 will in fact hold up. Price earnings multiples in late 2014 were in the high teens, higher than their long-run historical average, and dividend yields at 1.9% were well below their 4.5% historical average. To be sure, interest rates and inflation were both relatively low during 2014. When interest rates and inflation are low, somewhat higher price earnings multiples and lower dividend yields are justified. Still, we can't simply assume that rates will always be so low and that inflation will always be benign. The unexpected frequently happens. There is one predictable pattern in the stock market that also augurs for at best modest stock market returns over the longer term. Depending on the forecast horizon involved, as much as 40% of the variability of future market returns can be predicted on the basis of the initial P/E multiple of the market as a whole. Investors have earned higher total rates of return from the stock market when the initial P/E of the market portfolio was relatively low, and relatively low future rates of return when stocks were purchased at high P/E multiples. In measuring the P/E for the market, the calculations do not use actual earnings per share, but rather cyclically adjusted earnings. Thus, the measured P/Es are often referred to as CAPEs, CAPEs, cyclically adjusted P/E multiples. The CAPEs are available on Robert Shiller's website, and the earnings are calculated as average earnings over the last 10 years. Similar calculations can be obtained by averaging the past 5 years of earnings. The Shiller CAPE in 2014 averaged just over 25. CAPEs do a reasonably good job of forecasting returns a decade ahead and confirm the expectation presented here of modest single-digit returns over the years ahead. But if your investment period is for less than a decade, no one can predict the returns you will receive with any degree of accuracy. As a random walker on Wall Street, I am skeptical that anyone can predict the course of short-term stock price movements, and perhaps we are better off for it. I'm reminded of one of my favorite episodes from the marvelous old radio serial I Love a Mystery. This mystery was about a greedy stock market investor who wished that just once he would be allowed to see the paper with its stock price changes 24 hours in advance. By some occult twist, his wish was granted, and early in the evening he received the late edition of the next day's paper. He worked feverishly through the night, planning early morning purchases and late afternoon sales that would guarantee him a killing in the market. Then, before his elation had diminished, he read through the remainder of the paper and came upon his own obituary. His servant found him dead the next morning. Because I, fortunately, do not have access to future newspapers, I cannot tell how stock and bond prices will behave in any particular period ahead. Nevertheless, I am convinced that the moderate long-run estimates of bond and stock returns presented here are the most reasonable ones that can be made for investment planning decades into the 21st century. The point is not to invest with a rear-view mirror projecting double-digit returns from the past into the future. We are likely to be in a low-return environment for some time to come. Chapter 14. A Life Cycle Guide to Investing. From Mark Twain, Following the Equator. There are two times in a man's life when he should not speculate: when he can't afford it, and when he can. Investment strategy needs to be keyed to one's life cycle. A 34-year-old and a 68-year-old saving for retirement should use different financial instruments to accomplish their goals. The 34-year-old, just beginning to enter the peak years of salaried earnings, can use wages to cover any losses from increased risk. The 68-year-old, likely to depend on investment income to supplement or replace salary income, cannot risk incurring losses. Even the same financial instrument can mean different things to different people, depending on their capacity for risk. Although the 34-year-old and the 68-year-old may both invest in a certificate of deposit, the younger may do so because of an attitudinal aversion to risk, and the older because of a reduced capacity to accept risk. In the first case, one has more choice in how much risk to assume. In the second, one does not. The most important investment decision you will probably ever make concerns the balancing of asset categories: stocks, bonds, real estate, money market securities, and so on, at different stages of your life. According to Roger Ibbotson, who has spent a lifetime measuring returns from alternative portfolios, more than 90% of an investor's total return is determined by the asset categories that are selected and their overall proportional representation. Less than 10% of investment success is determined by the specific stocks or mutual funds that an individual chooses. In this chapter, I will show you that whatever your aversion to risk, whatever your position on the eat-well-sleep-well scale, your age, income from employment, and specific responsibilities in life go a long way toward helping you determine the mix of assets in your portfolio. 5. Asset Allocation Principles. Before we can determine a rational basis for making asset allocation decisions, certain principles must be kept firmly in mind. We've covered some of them implicitly in earlier chapters, but treating them explicitly here should prove very helpful. The key principles are: 1. History shows that risk and return are related. 2. The risk of investing in common stocks and bonds depends on the length of time the investments are held. The longer an investor's holding period, the lower the likely variation in the asset's return. 3. Dollar cost averaging can be a useful, though controversial, technique to reduce the risk of stock and bond investment. 4. Rebalancing can reduce risk and, in some circumstances, increase investment returns. 5. You must distinguish between your attitude toward and your capacity for risk. The risks you can afford to take depend on your total financial situation, including the types and sources of your income, exclusive of investment income. 1. risk and reward are related. Although you may be tired of hearing that investment rewards can be increased only by the assumption of greater risk, no lesson is more important in investment management. This fundamental law of finance is supported by centuries of historical data. Common stocks have provided very generous long-run rates of return. It has been estimated that if George Washington had put just $1 aside from his first presidential salary and invested it in common stocks, his heirs would have been millionaires more than 10 times over by 2014. Roger Ibbotson estimates that stocks have provided a compounded rate of return of more than 8% per year since 1790. Returns have been even more generous since 1926, when common stocks of large companies earned about 10%. But this return came only at substantial risk to investors. Total returns were negative in about 3 years out of 10. So, as you reach for higher returns, never forget the saying, "There ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Higher risk is the price one pays for more generous returns." 2. Your actual risk in stock and bond investing depends on the length of time you hold your investment. Your staying power, the length of time you hold on to your investment, plays a critical role in the actual risk you assume from any investment decision. Thus, your stage in the life cycle is a critical element in determining the allocation of your assets. Let's see why the length of your holding period is so important in determining your capacity for risk. Long-term government bonds have provided an average 6% annual rate of return over an 83-year period. The risk index, however, showed that in any single year this rate could stray far from the yearly average. Indeed, in many individual years it was actually negative. Early in the first decade of the 2000s, you could invest in a 5.25% 20-year U.S. Treasury bond, and if you held it for exactly 20 years, you would earn exactly 5.25%. The rub is that if you found that you had to sell it a year later, your rate of return could be 20%, 0%, or even a substantial loss if interest rates rose sharply, with existing bond prices falling to adjust to the new higher interest rates. I think you can see why your age and the likelihood that you can stay with your investment program can determine the amount of risk involved in any specific investment program. What about investing in common stocks? Could it be that the risk of investing in stocks also decreases with the length of time they are held? The answer is a qualified yes. A substantial amount, but not all, of the risk of common stock investment can be eliminated by adopting a program of long-term ownership and sticking to it through thick and thin, the buy-and-hold strategy discussed in earlier chapters. If you held a diversified stock portfolio, such as the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index, during the period from 1950 through 2013, you would have earned, on average, a quite generous return of about 10%. But the range of outcomes is certainly far too wide for an investor who has trouble sleeping at night. In 1 year, the rate of return from a typical stock portfolio was more than 52%, whereas in another year, it was negative by 37%. Clearly, there is no dependability of earning an adequate rate of return in any single year. A 1 year U.S. Treasury security or a 1 year government-guaranteed certificate of deposit is the investment for those who need the money next year. But the picture changes if you hold on to your common stock investments for 25 years, although there is some variability in the return achieved, depending on the exact 25-year period in question. That variability is not large. On average, investments over all 25-year periods covered by this figure has produced a rate of return of slightly more than 10%. This long-run expected rate of return was reduced by less than 3 percentage points if you happen to invest during the worst 25-year period since 1950. It is this fundamental truth that makes a life cycle view of investing so important. The longer the time period over which you can hold on to your investments, the greater should be the share of common stocks in your portfolio. In general, you are reasonably sure of earning the generous rates of return available from common stocks only if you can hold them for relatively long periods of time. Over investment periods of 20 or 30 years, stocks have generally been the clear winners, which further supports the advice that younger people should have a larger proportion of their assets in stocks than older people. I do not mean to argue that stocks are not risky over long holding periods. Certainly, the variability of the final value of your portfolio does increase the longer you hold your stocks. And we know that investors have experienced decades during which common stocks have produced near zero overall returns. But for investors whose holding periods can be measured in 25 years or more, and especially those who reinvest their dividends and even add to their holdings through dollar-cost averaging, common stocks are very likely to provide higher returns than are available from safe bonds and even safer government-guaranteed savings accounts. Finally, perhaps the most important reason for investors to become more conservative with age is that they have fewer years of paid labor ahead of them. Thus, they cannot count on salary income to sustain them if the stock market has a period of negative returns. Reverses in the stock market could then directly affect an individual's standard of living, and the steadier, even if smaller, returns from bonds represent the more prudent investment stance. Hence, stocks should make up a smaller proportion of their assets. 3. Dollar-cost averaging can reduce the risks of investing in stocks and bonds. If, like most people, you will be building up your investment portfolio slowly over time with the accretion of yearly savings, you will be taking advantage of dollar-cost averaging. This technique is controversial, but it does help you avoid the risk of putting all your money in the stock or bond market at the wrong time. Don't be alarmed by the fancy-sounding name. Dollar-cost averaging simply means investing the same fixed amount of money in, for example, the shares of some index mutual fund at regular intervals, say every month or quarter, over a long period of time. Periodic investments of equal dollar amounts in common stocks can reduce, but not avoid, the risks of equity investment by ensuring that the entire portfolio of stocks will not be purchased at temporarily inflated prices. Assume that $1,000 is invested each year. In one scenario, the market falls immediately after the investment program begins. Then it rises sharply and finally falls again, ending in year 5 exactly where it began. In a second scenario, the market rises continuously and ends up 40% higher. While exactly $5,000 is invested in both cases, the investor in the volatile market ends up with $6,048, a nice return of $1,048, even though the stock market ended exactly where it started. In the scenario where the market rose each year and ended up 40% from where it began, the investor's final stake is only $5,915. Warren Buffett presents a lucid rationale for this investment principle. In one of his published essays, he says, "A short quiz. If you plan to eat hamburgers throughout your life and are not a cattle producer, should you wish for higher or lower prices for beef? Likewise, if you are going to buy a car from time to time but are not an auto manufacturer, should you prefer higher or lower car prices?" These questions, of course, answer themselves, but now for the final exam. If you expect to be a net saver during the next 5 years, should you hope for a higher or lower stock market during that period? Many investors get this one wrong. Even though they are going to be net buyers of stocks for many years to come, they are elated when stock prices rise and depressed when they fall. In effect, they rejoice because prices have risen for the hamburgers they will soon be buying. This reaction makes no sense. Only those who will be sellers of equities in the near future should be happy at seeing stocks rise. Prospective purchasers should much prefer sinking prices. Dollar-cost averaging is not a panacea that eliminates the risk of investing in common stocks. It will not save your 401k plan from a devastating fall in value during a year such as 2008, because no plan can protect you from a punishing bear market. And you must have both the cash and the confidence to continue making the periodic investments even when the sky is the darkest. No matter how scary the financial news, no matter how difficult it is to see any signs of optimism, you must not interrupt the automatic pilot nature of the program. Because if you do, you will lose the benefit of buying at least some of your shares after a sharp market decline when they're for sale at low prices. Dollar-cost averaging will give you this bargain. Your average price per share will be lower than the average price at which you bought shares. Why? Because you'll buy more shares at low prices and fewer at high prices. Some investment advisors are not fans of dollar-cost averaging because the strategy is not optimal if the market does go straight up. You would have been better off putting all $5,000 into the market at the beginning of the period. But it does provide a reasonable insurance policy against poor future stock markets, and it does minimize the regret that inevitably follows if you were unlucky enough to have put all your money into the stock market during a peak period such as March of 2000 or October of 2007. To further illustrate the benefits of dollar-cost averaging, let's move from a hypothetical to a real example. Let's consider the results, ignoring taxes, of a $500 initial investment made on January 1, 1978, and thereafter $100 per month in the shares of the Vanguard 500 Index Mutual Fund. Less than $44,000 was committed to the program. The final value was over $480,000. Of course, no one can be sure that the next 45 years will provide the same returns as past periods, but the table does illustrate the tremendous potential gains possible from consistently following a dollar-cost averaging program. But remember, because there is a long-term uptrend in common stock prices, this technique is not necessarily appropriate if you need to invest a lump sum such as a bequest. If possible, keep a small reserve in a money fund to take advantage of market declines and buy a few extra shares if the market is down sharply. I'm not suggesting for a minute that you try to forecast the market. However, it's usually a good time to buy after the market has fallen out of bed. Just as hope and greed can sometimes feed on themselves to produce speculative bubbles, so do pessimism and despair react to produce market panics. The greatest market panics are just as unfounded as the most pathological speculative explosions. For the stock market as a whole, not for individual stocks, Newton's law has always worked in reverse. What goes down has come back up. 4. Rebalancing can reduce investment risk and possibly increase returns. A very simple investment technique called rebalancing can reduce investment risk and in some circumstances even increase investment returns. The technique simply involves bringing the proportions of your assets devoted to different asset classes, that is, stocks and bonds, back into the proportions suited to your age and your attitude toward and capacity for risk. Suppose you decided that your portfolio ought to consist of 60% stocks and 40% bonds, and at the start of your investment program, you divided your funds in those proportions between those two asset classes. But after 1 year, you discovered that your stocks had risen sharply while the bonds had fallen in price. So the portfolio was now 70% stocks and 30% bonds. A 70-30 mix would then appear to be a riskier allocation than the one most suitable for your risk tolerance. The rebalancing technique calls for selling some stocks or equity mutual funds and buying bonds to bring the allocation back to 60-40. Let's consider the results of a rebalancing strategy over the 20 years ending in December 2013. Every year, no more than once a year, the asset mix was brought back to the 60-40 initial allocation. Investments were made in low-cost index funds. We find that the volatility of the market value of the portfolio was markedly reduced by the rebalancing strategy. Moreover, rebalancing improved the average annual portfolio return. Without rebalancing, the portfolio returned 8.14% over the period. Rebalancing improved the annual rate of return to 8.41% with less volatility. What kind of alchemy permitted the investor who followed a rebalancing strategy at the end of each year to increase her rate of return? Think back to what was happening to the stock market over this period. By late 1999, the stock market had experienced an unprecedented bubble and equity values soared. The investor who rebalanced had no idea that the top of the market was near, but she did see that the equity portion of the portfolio had soared far above her 60% target. Thus, she sold enough equities and bought enough bonds to restore the original mix. Then, in late 2002, at just about the bottom of the bear market for stocks, and after a strong positive market for bonds, she found that the equity share was well below 60%, and the bond share was well above 40%, and she rebalanced into stocks. Again, at the end of 2008, when stocks had plummeted and bonds had risen, she sold bonds and bought stocks. We all wish that we had a little genie who could reliably tell us to buy low and sell high. Systematic rebalancing is the closest analog we have. 5. Distinguishing between your attitude toward and your capacity for risk. As I mentioned at the beginning of this chapter, the kinds of investments that are appropriate for you depend significantly on your non-investment sources of income. Your earning ability outside your investments and thus your capacity for risk is usually related to your age. 3 illustrations will help you understand this concept. Mildred G. is a recently widowed 64-year-old. She has been forced to give up her job as a registered nurse because of increasingly severe arthritis. Her modest house in Homewood, Illinois, is still mortgaged. Although the mortgage was taken out at a relatively low rate, it involves substantial monthly payments. Apart from monthly Social Security checks, all Mildred has to live on are the earnings on a $250,000 insurance policy of which she is the beneficiary and a $50,000 portfolio of small growth stocks accumulated by her late husband. It is clear that Mildred's capacity to bear risk is severely constrained by her financial situation. She has neither the life expectancy nor the physical ability to earn income outside her portfolio. Moreover, she has substantial fixed expenditures on her mortgage. She would have no ability to recoup a loss on her portfolio. She needs a portfolio of safe investments that can generate substantial income. Bonds and high dividend-paying stocks, as from an index fund of real estate investment trusts, are the kinds of investments that are suitable. Risky, often non-dividend-paying stocks of small growth companies, no matter how attractive their prices may be, do not belong in Mildred's portfolio. Tiffany B. is an ambitious, single, 26-year-old who recently completed an MBA at Stanford's Graduate School of Business and has entered a training program at the Bank of America. She just inherited a $50,000 legacy from her grandmother's estate. Her goal is to build a sizable portfolio that in later years could finance the purchase of a home and be available as a retirement nest egg. For Tiffany, one can safely recommend an aggressive portfolio. She has both the life expectancy and the earning power to maintain her standard of living in the face of any financial loss. Although her personality will determine the precise amount of risk exposure she is willing to undertake, it is clear that Tiffany's portfolio belongs toward the far end of the risk-reward spectrum. Mildred's portfolio of small growth stocks would be far more appropriate for Tiffany than for a 64-year-old widow who is unable to work. In the 9th edition of this book, I presented the case of Carl P., a 43-year-old foreman at a General Motors production plant in Pontiac, Michigan, who made over $70,000 per year. His wife, Joan, had a $12,500 annual income from selling Avon products. The Peas had 4 children, ages 6 to 15. Carl and Joan wanted all the children to attend college. They realized that private colleges were probably beyond their means, but hoped that an education within the excellent Michigan State University system would be feasible. Fortunately, Carl had been saving regularly through the GM payroll savings plan, but had chosen the option of purchasing GM stock under the plan. He had accumulated GM stock worth $219,000. He had no other assets, but did have substantial equity in a modest house with only a small mortgage remaining to be paid off. I suggested that Carl and Joan had a highly problematic portfolio. Both their income and their investments were tied up in GM. A negative development that caused a sharp loss in GM's common stock could ruin both the value of the portfolio and Carl's livelihood. Indeed, the story ended badly. General Motors declared bankruptcy in 2009. Carl lost his job, as well as his investment portfolio. And this is not an isolated example. Remember the sad lesson learned by many Enron employees who lost not only their jobs but all their savings in Enron stock when the company went under. Never take on the same risks in your portfolio that attach to your major source of income. 3 guidelines to tailoring a life cycle investment plan. Now that I have set the stage, the next sections present a life cycle guide to investing. We will look here at some general rules that will be serviceable for most individuals at different stages of their lives. In the next section, I summarize them in an investment guide. Of course, no guide will fit every individual case. Any game plan will require some alteration to fit individual circumstances. This section reviews three broad guidelines that will help you tailor an investment plan to your particular circumstances. 1. Specific needs require dedicated specific assets. Always keep in mind, a specific need must be funded with specific assets dedicated to that need. Consider a young couple in their 20s attempting to build a retirement nest egg. The advice in the life cycle investment guide that follows is certainly appropriate to meet those long-term objectives. But suppose that the couple expects to need a $30,000 down payment to purchase a house next year. That $30,000 to meet a specific need should be invested in a safe security maturing when the money is required, such as a one-year certificate of deposit, CD. Similarly, if college tuitions will be needed in 3, 4, 5, and 6 years, funds might be invested in zero-coupon securities of the appropriate maturity or in different CDs. 2. Recognize your tolerance for risk. By far the biggest individual adjustment to the general guidelines suggested concerns your own attitude toward risk. It is for this reason that successful financial planning is more of an art than a science. General guidelines can be extremely helpful in determining what proportion of a person's funds should be deployed among different asset categories. But the key to whether any recommended asset allocation works for you is whether you are able to sleep at night. Risk tolerance is an essential aspect of any financial plan, and only you can evaluate your attitude toward risk. You can take some comfort in the fact that the risk involved in investing in common stocks and long-term bonds is reduced the longer the time period over which you accumulate and hold your investments. But you must have the temperament to accept considerable short-term fluctuations in your portfolio's value. How did you feel when the market fell by almost 50% in 2008? If you panicked and became physically ill because a large proportion of your assets was invested in common stocks, then clearly you should pare down the stock portion of your portfolio. Thus, subjective considerations also play a major role in the asset allocations you can accept, and you may legitimately stray from those recommended here depending on your aversion to risk. 3. Persistent saving in regular amounts, no matter how small, pays off. One final preliminary before presenting the asset allocation guide. What do you do if right now you have no assets to allocate? So many people of limited means believe that it is impossible to build up a sizable nest egg. Accumulating meaningful amounts of retirement savings often seems out of reach. Don't despair. The fact is that a program of regular saving each week, persistently followed as through a payroll savings or 401k retirement plan, can in time produce substantial sums of money. Can you afford to put aside $23 per week or $11.50 per week? If you can, the possibility of eventually accumulating a large retirement fund is easily attainable if you have many working years ahead of you. If we consider the results from a regular savings program of $100 per month, where an interest rate of 7% is assumed as an investment rate, it is clear that regular savings of even moderate amounts make the attainment of meaningful sums of money entirely possible, even for those who start off with no nest egg at all. If you can put a few thousand dollars into the savings fund to begin with, the final sum will be increased significantly. Pick no-load mutual funds to accumulate your nest egg because direct investments of small sums of money can be prohibitively expensive. Also, mutual funds permit automatic reinvestment of interest or dividends and capital gains. Finally, make sure you check whether your employer has a matched savings plan. Obviously, if by saving through a company-sponsored retirement plan, you are able to match your savings with company contributions and gain tax deductions as well, your nest egg will grow that much faster. The Life Cycle Investment Guide. In the Talmud, Rabbi Isaac said that one should always divide one's wealth into three parts, a third in land, a third in merchandise, business, and a third ready at hand in liquid form. Such an asset allocation is hardly unreasonable, but we can improve on this ancient advice because we have more refined instruments and a greater appreciation of the considerations that make different asset allocations appropriate for different people. For those in their 20s, a very aggressive investment portfolio is recommended. At this age, there's lots of time to ride out the peaks and valleys of investment cycles, and you have a lifetime of earnings from employment ahead of you. The portfolio is not only heavy in common stocks, but also contains a substantial proportion of international stocks, including the higher-risk emerging markets. As mentioned in Chapter 8, one important advantage of international diversification is risk reduction. Plus, international diversification enables an investor to gain exposure to other growth areas in the world, even as world markets become more closely correlated. As investors age, they should start cutting back on riskier investments and start increasing the proportion of the portfolio committed to bonds and bond substitutes, such as dividend growth stocks. The allocation is also increased to REITs that pay generous dividends. By the age of 55, investors should start thinking about the transition to retirement and moving the portfolio toward income production. The proportion of bonds and bond substitutes increases, and the stock portfolio becomes more conservative and income-producing and less growth-oriented. In retirement, a portfolio heavily weighted in a variety of bonds and bond substitutes is recommended. A general rule of thumb used to be that the proportion of bonds in one's portfolio should equal one's age. Nevertheless, even in one's late 60s, I suggest that 40% of the portfolio be committed to ordinary common stocks and 15% to real estate equities, REITs, to give some income growth to cope with inflation. For most people, I recommend starting with a broad-based total stock market index fund rather than individual stocks for portfolio formation. I do so for two reasons. First, most people do not have sufficient capital to buy properly diversified portfolios themselves. Second, I recognize that most young people will not have substantial assets and will be accumulating portfolios by monthly investments. This makes mutual funds almost a necessity. As your assets grow, a U.S. stock market fund should be augmented with a total international stock index fund that includes stocks from fast-growing emerging markets. Make sure that any mutual funds you buy are truly no-load and low-cost. I said earlier that everyone should attempt to own his or her own home. I believe that everyone should have substantial real estate holdings, and some part of one's equity holdings should be in real estate investment trust REIT index mutual funds described in Chapter 12. With respect to your bond holdings, the guide recommends taxable bonds. If, however, you are in the highest tax bracket and live in a high-tax state such as New York, and your bonds are held outside of your retirement plan, I recommend that you use tax-exempt money funds and bond funds tailored to your state so that they are exempt from both federal and state taxes. Life cycle funds. Do you want to avoid the hassle of adjusting your portfolio as you age and rebalancing yearly as the proportions of your assets devoted to different asset classes vary with the ups and downs of the market? A new type of product has been developed during the 2000s just for those investors who want to set up a program and then forget about it. It is called the Life Cycle Fund, and it automatically does the rebalancing and moves to a safer asset allocation as you age. Life Cycle Funds are extremely useful for IRAs, 401ks, and other retirement plans. You pick the particular life cycle fund that is appropriate by picking a date when you expect to retire. For example, suppose you are 40 years old in 2015 and you plan to retire at age 70. You should then buy a life cycle fund with a target maturity 2045. Subsequent contributions can be directed to the same fund. The fund will be rebalanced annually, and the equity mix will become more conservative over time. The major mutual fund complexes such as Vanguard, Fidelity, American Century, and T. Rowe Price all offer life cycle funds. Details of the different maturities and the asset allocations offered may be found at the various company websites. When bond yields are extremely low, I tend to favor the life cycle funds that are more aggressive, that is, that start off with a larger allocation to equities. For those looking for the easiest way to manage their retirement monies, the automatic pilot aspect of life cycle funds is a user-friendly feature. But before you sign up, check the fee schedule. Low fees mean more money in your pocket to enjoy a more comfortable retirement. Investment management once you have retired. More than 10,000 baby boomers are reaching the age of 65 each day, a pattern that will continue until year 2030. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, more than 1 million baby boomers will live beyond the age of 100. A typical 65-year-old has an average life expectancy of about 20 years, and half of all retirees will live longer than their average life expectancy. Yet most boomers have not heeded the advice in this book and have failed to save adequately for retirement. We have been a nation of consumers rather than savers. Given the long-run state of the federal budget, we can't rely on the government to bail us out. Inadequate preparation for retirement. According to a survey of consumer finances conducted by the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, the typical American family has little money in the bank and considerable credit card debt. Only half of all Americans have any kind of retirement account, and only 11% of Americans in the bottom wealth quartile have a savings or retirement plan. While older Americans between the ages of 55 and 64 have, on average, $308,000 in retirement savings, that amount would not be sufficient to replace more than 15% of their household income in retirement.